Curry, but knew Chambers. And today we have with us Albany High School students. Would they stand, please? Well, welcome. You may be seated. The Albany High School students are here with our Court with Class program, a program that the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court have organized. This program brings high school students in to observe an oral argument. And the high school students have been given briefs or other materials about the cases they're going to hear. And at noon, the Albany High School students will join with the Berlin High School students and Boscobel High School students and meet with retired Chief Justice Day. They will meet right here in this courtroom. I'm also delighted to welcome for both this argument and the next argument Israeli public defenders who are here in a program with the Wisconsin State Public Defender's Office. Would the Israeli public defenders please stand? Thank you and welcome to you. For both arguments, you may be seated, and the court and others will have lunch with the Israeli public defenders. Chief Justice Day will then join us. Now that we have met you, I would like to introduce the court to you. Starting on my far right is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left, our newest Justice, Diane Sykes. Now that the introductions have been made, we'll call our first case, which is State v. Vanessa D. Hughes. Mr. Balistrary represents the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to, at the very outset of this argument, make one point very clear, and that is that the state is relying on two alternative justifications to justify this, the entry of the police into the apartment of Vanessa Hughes. When the police arrived at the apartment, as the court already knows, of course, they smelled a strong odor of marijuana coming from the apartment. They believed that marijuana was being smoked inside, and because of that belief, they entered the apartment without a warrant of any kind, either an arrest warrant or a search warrant. The state believes that this entry into the apartment can be justified under, as I say, two alternative theories. These theories are different, but they are closely related, and it's easy to confuse the justification for the searches, for the entry, but they must be kept separate, because if you start confusing the justifications and the rationales for the two separate justifications for the entry, it's easy to confuse this whole case.
Mr. Balistrary, I just have a question on the facts. I thought that the smell of marijuana did not become apparent until after the door was open. Are you saying it's before you said?
No, it was not apparent until the door was open.
Okay.
No, that's correct. You're correct.
Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that question.
Well, the question was the smell of marijuana apparent before the door was open?
And my answer was no, it was not. It was only after the door was open that they smelled it. The first justification deals with the right of the police to enter premises without a warrant when there are exigent circumstances. In particular, an exigent circumstance, in this case, the danger of the destruction of evidence if the police do not enter immediately and seize the evidence. This justification for the search applies only under the United States Supreme Court's decision in Welch versus Wisconsin if the police enter to seize evidence of a quote-unquote serious crime. The second justification that the state offers for the entry into the apartment is that the police had a right to enter the apartment without a warrant to arrest persons who were committing a misdemeanor in their presence. And I would like to make clear that the distinction between these two justifications is that in the first one, the exigent circumstances to prevent destruction of evidence, the state needs to show that the police entered to prevent the destruction of evidence of a serious crime, whatever that might be. In the second case, even assuming, we are assuming that the crime for which the police enter is not a serious crime, that it's simply a misdemeanor of any kind, whether it's serious or not serious. So we're not trying to justify the search on the second theory on the ground that it is a serious crime, but simply a misdemeanor. The justification is that the misdemeanor is committed in the presence of the officers.
As to the second, what's your authority?
My authority is some cases of this court that go back a ways, but that have never been overruled. Hawkins versus Lutton is the first of those. And this court has very clearly held that the police can enter premises without a warrant when they see a misdemeanor committed in their presence.
Well, when I was writing the dissent in Welsh, I checked to see about when police can make an arrest. Now, that was a civil offense.
Well, one was a civil case and one was a criminal case.
And I found a great doubt about the right to arrest, unless there was a disorderly conduct, so that it affected the public. Because you could just give write up a complaint later and make and serve it without an arrest. But I'll look at Hawkins.
I thought that issue was in great doubt. No, I think that your doubt will be resolved if you look at the history of the evolution of the right of the police to make an arrest for a misdemeanor. And you're correct that at one time the police were only permitted to arrest for a misdemeanor without a warrant when that misdemeanor was disorderly conduct. That is true. Historically, at one time, that was true. The law has evolved since then, and the law has evolved to the point where the rule is now, both by judicial decisions of this court and by statute, that the police can make a warrantless arrest for any misdemeanor. So we've expanded the rule.
Any U.S. Supreme Court case on that?
There's a whole bunch of U.S. Supreme Court cases on that I've cited in my brief, Peyton versus New York, and just a bunch of cases that talk about the distinction between the rule for making warrantless felony arrests and warrantless misdemeanor arrests. So it's a pretty well established proposition in the law now that we have expanded this common law principle.
Is there any case that would indicate that the police have a right to enter a home in order to arrest persons who are committing a misdemeanor?
Yes, the case is from this court. Hawkins versus Lutton and State versus Edwards are the two cases. Edwards versus State are the two cases in which this court has specifically authorized the police to enter premises without a warrant to arrest for a misdemeanor committed in their presence.
Does the Welch case impact on your second theory?
Of course it does. The Welch case impacts on both of my theories. Welch left more questions unanswered, I think, than it did answer. Welch answered one question, or the U.S. Supreme Court decision of Welch answered one question, and that is that the police cannot enter premises without a warrant to either search for evidence of or make an arrest for an offense which is not criminal, that is, an offense which does not provide for incarceration as a punishment. That's the only question that Welch actually answered. The other two questions, the ones that are being posed here today, are questions that are both left open by Welch. Now, as far as the justification for entering premises without a warrant to arrest for a misdemeanor, Welch very cryptically indicates that even if there are some offenses that do not qualify as serious offenses, whatever that may be, and that's another question that the court has to answer today, or at least that we're asking the court to answer today, even if they don't qualify as serious, there are some circumstances in which the police can nevertheless enter the premises to make an arrest. And as examples, the Supreme Court cited two cases of lower courts in which the police were permitted to enter premises when they were in hot pursuit of a defendant who had committed a misdemeanor in their presence. So there is some suggestion in Welch by citing those two cases. And the court, I have to admit, did make clear that it was neither approving nor disapproving those cases. It was simply citing those cases as examples where lower courts had authorized the entry of premises for offenses that were not serious. But at least in those cases, lower courts had held that. The United States Supreme Court did not disapprove of those cases, and it indicated that maybe it did approve of those cases. And subsequent to Welch, there are a number of lower court decisions that have approved that proposition.
Counsel, who was committing a misdemeanor in their presence?
We don't know specifically.
How was it being committed?
It was being committed by smoking marijuana, by possessing marijuana and smoking it.
Who, how, what, when, why, and sometimes, whatever, the final one. The reason of my question is to probe what in presence means. If you don't know who it is, if you don't know how it's happening, does that fit within the definition of in the presence? Normally I would say in my presence is I see it, and some of the cases deal with I see it happening. Now this was a close
smell
door.
It happening.
Is that in your presence?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, there's
what's
authority
the
for that.
What's the definition of in the presence?
That the police can, with one of their senses, determine that a crime is being committed.
And where do you get that definition?
From Lefebvre.
But they never said it was burning, right? It was just the odor of marijuana.
Well, they didn't use the magic word burning. They did use the magic word smoking. So, the old legal proposition where there's smoke, there's fire. So if they say they smelled this odor, they thought from the odor that marijuana was being smoked in their presence, one can infer that the marijuana was burning, because you wouldn't have smoke unless you had burning marijuana.
Counsel, it's your position that Lefebvre stands with the proposition that the definition of in the presence is that with one of the senses? That's
yes,
the definition.
And Lefebvre specifically talks about smell. He says that a crime can be committed in the presence of the police if they smell the odor of drugs.
I want to explore that in the presence, too. The windows were open here. People are outside, and I saw a big marijuana plant on the marshal's desk. Is that in the presence of the officers?
If they were right outside the window?
Yeah.
Unquestionably. The fact that there's a wall in between the marshal's desk and the police that are outside is not the controlling factor. The controlling factor is that the police are able to determine with one of their senses that a crime is in the process of being committed.
All the senses, the hearing to smell, sight, hearing?
Yes. Yes.
But any one of the senses could be controlled. In other words, you you can smell, but you can't see is what you're saying.
Right. You don't need all of the senses together. Any one of the senses is sufficient. Right. You could hear people are conspiring to commit a crime. That's even if you can't see them, even if they're on the other side of the door, you can't see them, but you can hear them. That's a crime being committed in the presence of the officers. And you don't have to know specifically who's committing the crime. The officers here did not know the names of the people who were smoking the marijuana. They knew there were people in the apartment, a number of people. They had a pretty good idea who some of those people were, or at least two of those people were, and that's sufficient.
So why didn't they find evidence of marijuana? Why didn't they find marijuana?
Because as the police entered the apartment, the defendant's younger sister screamed, alerted some of the people who were in the apartment, and two of them made a mad dash for the back bedrooms, and we suspect taking the marijuana with them.
Well, didn't they search the back bedrooms?
Well, apparently they didn't hide it in the back bedrooms, apparently. Either went out the window or down the toilet.
Was there a testimony that they heard the toilet flush?
No, there was testimony that there was a lot of yelling and screaming and noise, so there was no opportunity for them to hear that. They did find, however, we do know these. We do know these facts. Both the defendant and her sister expressly admitted at the suppression hearing that people were, in fact, smoking marijuana in the apartment. So there's no question about that. Secondly, the police, although they did not find marijuana, they did find empty baggies indicating that there was something like drugs in those baggies, and they found what is called a blunt. It's a cigar that's hollowed out and stuffed with marijuana, and the tobacco and marijuana are smoked together. So they found an implement for smoking marijuana. They did find that.
Could you enlighten me, why were the police at Ms. Hughes' door?
They were called by a security officer in the apartment who told them that there were two people in Hughes' apartment who were not supposed to be in the building. They had been banned from the building because of their previous conduct, which included involvement with drugs.
So based on that, did they have enough to just... They knew the apartment, it was pointed out by the security guard.
Right.
And they were going, as I understand it, they were going up there to knock on the door to make an inquiry.
That's correct.
And
that's
then
what
events took over.
Yes.
I'm sorry. If when they knocked on the door, if Michael Webb had opened the door or had been sitting there in plain view, what would they have done? No smell. What would they have done?
Well, I think they would have talked to Michael Webb and would have said, what are you doing in this building? You're not supposed to be here. Would you like to come with us outside?
Could they cross the threshold to talk to him, or do they have to shout over it? Suppose the door was closed.
Well, if the door was closed, they wouldn't have had any idea that he was in the apartment.
The door is opened. You look in, you see Michael Webb. Under Justice Press's scenario, you see Michael Webb. And he doesn't want to come out. Can the police cross the threshold and take him out and make an arrest? Because I guess it's trespass.
If he is told that he is not supposed to be in the building and he refuses to leave, I would say that that's probably a crime like disorderly conduct. Or, as you say, trespass is probably some kind of misdemeanor. And certainly being committed in the presence of the officers, I believe they would have a right to cross the threshold to remove him and arrest him.
Even though the legal occupant of the apartment wants him there?
That's correct.
Well, they had the owner of the apartment. I think this was factually, they'd had some drug dealing, so it was identified as a place where drugs had been used, and the owner of the apartment, as I understand, the landlord,
right,
had indicated that if these people came upon the premises, they could be arrested for trespass.
That's correct. Yeah. It was, it's, It's not so much a question of them being in the apartment of Vanessa Hughes, but of them being in the building. The owner of the building did not want them in the building at all and considered their presence to be a trespass.
I guess the question is, the justice is asking Justice Bradley is, once they got into the apartment, does the landlord still have the right to control that?
I think the landlord has the right to control access to the building. These people didn't.
You wrote a case about that.
These people didn't.
We disagree with you, counsel.
They didn't fly. These people did not fly in on a helicopter. They had to enter the building somehow.
Well, that may be a point someone's going to make. I'm waiting.
Counsel, I want to focus on what did they know as they stand there in the door? And one of your alternate theories is if a crime is being committed in their presence. Did they know at the time that they stood at the door that this would have been a first offense marijuana or a second offense possession of marijuana or third offense possession of marijuana?
No, they didn't know that.
And of course, as a first offense, it can be charged as a civil forfeiture, can't it?
Within the discretion of the prosecutor.
And as a first offense under 96147, if it's charged as a civil forfeiture, it can even be a disposition of no conviction at all with a conditional discharge. Isn't that right?
That is correct.
So as they stood at the door and they smelled marijuana, they had no idea if this was a crime, if it would be charged as a crime or a forfeiture or what the disposition would be for a first offense. Is that right?
They had no idea what the disposition might be, but they certainly knew that a crime was being committed.
They had no
idea. The fact that alternatively an offense can be charged as a civil offense or as a crime doesn't mean it isn't a crime. It's still a crime.
Let me rephrase that. They had no idea then, as they stood at the door, whether or not the smell of marijuana would result in a civil forfeiture, if at all, would result in a civil forfeiture or a criminal conviction. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes.
And as the officers stood at the threshold of the Welch door, they had no idea whether or not it was a first offense OWI resulting in a civil forfeiture or a multiple offense OWI and resulting in possible incarceration. Is that correct?
That is also correct.
And yet in Welsh, the U.S. Supreme Court said it wasn't a serious offense, so you couldn't go into his home without a warrant.
And that is also correct.
So why can't you say that here? This is on all fours with Welsh, and that you have to assume that this is not a serious offense.
This is not on all fours with Welsh. This is the question, as I said when I started my argument, that was left unresolved in Welsh. There are differences here. This is not a civil forfeiture. This is a crime. These people were committing a crime. The fact that they may have not been prosecuted for committing a crime doesn't mean that they were not committing a crime. They were committing a crime.
Driving under the influence is a crime here, too, depending on how many times you've done it.
Well, even for the first offense, this is a crime. And that's the distinction. For a first offense drunk driving, it's not a crime. A first offense possession of marijuana is a crime. It is a misdemeanor.
And the difference is, of course, is that as you escalate, the second offense is a felony.
And the second offense is a felony.
And is 96147 allowing for conditional discharge for possession of marijuana, is that, in your opinion, a statement of the legislature as that touches upon the import of the first offense crime?
Absolutely not. As far as I'm concerned, what it says is that you've committed a serious offense, but if there are other circumstances justifying some kind of penalty less than incarceration, we're going to give you a break. And I would hasten to add at this point that under the analysis of what constitutes a serious offense in Blanton versus City of North Las Vegas, the United States Supreme Court says what you have to look to is the maximum possible penalty for the offense. You don't look at the minimum penalties. I mean, you can get probation for anything. And for many, many offenses.
But you can't get probation in this sense. This sense, under 961.47, says, hey, in first offense, marijuana possession, we're going to clean the slate. This isn't a matter of probation and a conviction. This is a matter of we're not even going to give you a conviction.
That's correct.
I want to touch upon the minor offense stuff. On Welch, the Supreme Court refrained from imposing an absolute ban on warrantless home arrests for minor offenses. Is that correct?
That's right. That's exactly right.
And you cite that proposition in of the Welch case in your Court of Appeals brief, and then you footnote that quote from Welch and say, however, the state concedes that the offense apparent to police in this case, possession of marijuana, is minor since the maximum penalty is only 6 months in jail. I understand that in your reply brief, you're modifying that concession. Is that correct? Or further explaining that?
Well, I explain it. I said that concession is not made in the context of the first argument. It's not made in the first argument in this brief. It's not made in the context of discussing whether an offense is serious or not serious under the Blanton criteria. That
footnote, isn't it made in the context of the Welch definition? I mean, you put footnote one right after you cite Welch. You say Welch stands for the proposition that on a warrantless arrest for minor offenses, you can't do it. And then you say footnote one, and I concede this is a minor offense. So I didn't
that's
quite
in
understand.
That's in the context of the second argument, and this is why I said at the outset that you have to distinguish between the two arguments that I'm making here. That concession was made in the context of the second argument that the police could enter premises when a misdemeanor was committed in their presence, whether or not that misdemeanor was serious under the Blanton rule.
Well, Mr. Valasperi, why would you use different definitions of seriousness in your two justifications? Why would Welch do that? Or why would any case do that?
Because of the type of public interest that's involved in the two justifications. In the one case, in the first case where I'm saying that you have to have a serious, well, I'm not saying that's the Welsh court saying it, that you have to have a serious offense to justify the entry. What the police are doing is entering premises only to salvage evidence. Now, that's important, but in some cases it's not that important. Under the second rationale, where the police are entering premises to stop a crime that's being committed in their presence, that's a much more important rationale. The whole idea of the criminal law is not simply to arrest criminals. It's not simply to punish criminals. The whole reason that we arrest criminals and punish them is to stop people from committing crimes. That's what we want the criminal law to do. I mean, the criminal law would be very happy if there were no criminals to arrest and no criminals to punish. The law has often said, this court has often said, the U.S. Supreme Court has often said, that the police, when they see a crime being committed, do not have to simply shrug their shoulders and allow it to go on being committed. And that applies no matter how serious the offense is.
Thank you, Mr. Bell.
Thank you.
You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Andrea Taylor Cornwall, Assistant State Public Defender, representing the defendant, Lance Hughes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I'm asking today that this court affirm the Court of Appeals decision in this case. I think there is plenty of support for the Court of Appeals decision. The Court of Appeals was right under U.S. Supreme Court case law in Johnson versus United States and in Welsh versus Wisconsin. The Court of Appeals decision was right under this court's decision in State versus Sechrist and State versus Brockman. And the Court of Appeals was also right under its decisions in State versus Kiekhaefer, as well as most recently State versus Wilson. I think what's important to remember here is that we are talking about the sanctity of the home. This is not a situation where we are talking about a car, but we're talking about the level of protection that the Fourth Amendment provides for the sanctity of a home, and that is the highest level of protection that the Fourth Amendment provides. And how we're protected is through the issuance of a warrant, and the warrant is to be issued by a neutral magistrate. And that's the protection that we have from the police crossing that firm threshold to our home. So it's not a mere formality. The neutral magistrate is the one who's to decide when does our right to privacy in our home have to yield to the government need for intrusion. So I'm asking this court today to reaffirm that there is special protection in the Fourth Amendment for the sanctity of the home. And the rule that I would ask this court to adopt in this case is that the odor of marijuana does not justify police entry into the home without a warrant.
Let me ask you, does it make a difference in this case how, and I agree with what you're saying as far as the sanctity of the home, does it make a difference in this case how the police got there at all? I mean, does it make a difference because they were called by a security guard to enforce a trespass law involving two individuals that were not connected at least directly with what we're talking about? Does that make a difference that they're there not under their, let's say, their own volition, but they were called to enforce this, and they got to this door and they knocked, and then a chain of events took place? Does that make a difference other than, because you're talking about a warrant, they wouldn't have gotten a warrant here anyway, because what took place, they weren't thinking of a warrant. They were responding to a citizen's call to come to this residence or this apartment building, and we have two people that aren't supposed to be here, and they went in that door.
I understand Justice's concern. I think what we have to focus on is what happened once the police got to the door. Certainly they were not called there on a report of any drug activity going on in that apartment at that time. They were there responding to a trespass, but I think we have to look at what happened once they got to the door, because that is the point, I think, where they entered the apartment is where we have to look at should they have gone and gotten a warrant, and that is our contention here, that they should have gone and gotten a warrant. So the fact that they were called
Are you saying that if someone says that there's a trespass and they went in there and they're not supposed to be there, police should go get a warrant each time before?
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying that what happened after the door was opened and they smelled the odor of marijuana, that is the point where they should have taken it to a neutral magistrate who's to determine what is the effect of that smell of marijuana and should the sanctity of the home be breached by the officer's entry at that point. So I don't think that the fact that they were called there, I'm not suggesting that they should have gotten a warrant before they got to the door. I don't have a problem with their getting to the door. It's what happened after the door was opened.
Since we look at reasonableness, what's reasonable? Is that reasonable that, there's smell of marijuana, we'll go back and get a warrant? I mean, just...
I think that it is reasonable under the circumstances of this case. The state makes much in its brief of the smell of burning marijuana, and number one, that's certainly not supported in the record. What the officers testified to at pages 6 and 31 is a strong odor of marijuana. There's no indication that it was burning at that time. But even if this court would accept the state's interpretation that means it was burning, it simply does not matter under Johnson versus United States, as well as the Court of Appeals decision in Kiekhaefer, because Johnson dealt with that very specific issue. Does the odor of burning marijuana provide a reason for the police to enter without a warrant? And the court in Johnson said, no, that is not enough, even where the substance is burning. And I don't think the state can distinguish this case from the facts in Johnson, and this court cannot overrule Johnson. So I think that it is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment to expect that the officers would go to a neutral magistrate. The police are not the ones to be making the determination of what inference to draw, even under those circumstances.
Are you saying that under Johnson, had they gone to a magistrate, the magistrate could not have appropriately issued a warrant?
No, Johnson says that in some cases where a magistrate finds that the officers are qualified to know the odor, that it is appropriate to issue a search warrant. So in principle, certainly, odor of marijuana does provide probable cause for a search warrant to be issued. And that is the problem that I have with this case, is that there was no attempt to get a search warrant.
Okay, so then apparently you are hinging your case on the seriousness of the crime. Is that correct?
One aspect of our argument is that it simply was not serious enough, but we also disagree that there were exigent circumstances in this case. I don't think there were exigent circumstances to begin with. Number one, based on the odor of marijuana, I think Johnson says that simply is not exigent enough to enter into an apartment or to a home. Secondly, the state is relying on the sister's scream, and I think, again, that is not borne out by the record. There's no testimony that the officers relied on any scream by the sister. They simply did not testify about a scream. The testimony that's in the record is somewhat ambiguous, but I think the best reading of the record from Ms. Hughes and her sister was that the scream itself occurred as the police entered.
Mr. Balistrieri, in his argument, referred to the fact that the record reflects that the officer said smoking marijuana.
One of the officers testified that based upon the strong odor of marijuana, he had a belief that they were smoking marijuana. But again, that's an inference that he made. There's no testimony that any smoke was observed, that when he testified when the door was opened, he did not observe anyone smoking. So all we have is simply the strong odor of marijuana. And again, even if it's assumed that that meant burning marijuana, Johnson says that is not enough to make a warrantless entry into a home.
Ms. Cornwall, let's assume that you're right, that there should not have been the entry into the home. The officers end up in the home. Trial court found there was consent for the search. How do you get around State versus Phillips?
State versus Phillips? Well, we have an alternative argument in this case, and that is independent of the warrantless entry. Is this court referring to our alternative argument that there was no voluntary consent?
Well, the trial court found there was.
Right. What our argument is in this case is that as a matter of law, there was not voluntary consent, even based on the factual findings that the trial court found. And the trial court specifically relied on Officer Tina Kirst, the female officer, her testimony, and found that that established consent. And our argument in this court is that is an independent basis for this court to find, regardless of the entry by police, even if that entry was legal, that the consent by Ms. Hughes was not voluntary as a matter of law. What the officer Kirth testified to is that she approached Ms. Hughes and said to her, "I'm here to search you, all right," and that Ms. Hughes responded, "Okay." And our argument in this court is that that mere acquiescence is not a clear, unequivocal, non-ambiguous assertion of consent, and it was the state's burden to show that there was an unequivocal assertion of consent, and that was not done here.
What's the standard of review of this court? Circuit court finding of consent.
This court must accept the court's factual findings, but independently applies those findings to find whether there is, in fact, as a matter of constitutional fact, a finding of consent. And our argument is that, those factual findings do not, as a matter of law, establish consent.
Well, I was thinking also about the attenuation situation. When I look at Phillips and I look at this case, it seems to me there's a lot stronger argument for attenuation in this case than there was in Phillips.
Well, I respectfully disagree. There are, as this court knows, there are three factors in Phillips. Number one, we have the temporal proximity. There is no specific testimony in the record as to how long elapsed from the point the police entered until Ms. Hughes allegedly gave her consent. But Officer Marlock did testify that it was less than 5 to 10 minutes before the backup officers arrived, and apparently Ms. Hughes was not searched until after the backup officers had arrived. So I think we are talking about a matter of minutes. Secondly, we have a situation where the conditions surrounding the alleged consent are essentially the same. The officers did not remove her from the scene. There was no indication that this was a congenial atmosphere or that there was some type of congenial conversation that went on. Ms. Hughes testified that she objected continuously while the police were searching her apartment. And her children were apparently crying and very scared. And the circumstances of the entry, I think, were certainly enough for the conditions to be found not to be attenuated. Secondly, we have the intervening circumstances. Again, she was not removed from the premises. She and the other occupants were forced to remain where they were. This was a very short time period, and there was nothing that intervened. She was not handcuffed or told she was under arrest. She was not given Miranda rights. There was nothing that would attenuate as to intervening circumstances. And finally, I think that the purpose and the flagrancy of the police conduct here really go against most strongly the attenuation. We have police officers entering with guns drawn, and that was the testimony of all the defense witnesses. One of the officers said it was more than likely that he had his gun drawn as he came in and ordered the occupants to stay where they were and put their hands up. Ms. Hughes did not consent to the entry, and so there was no reason for her to believe that her consent in this case would have any that her refusal would have any weight. And furthermore, the police in this case did not they did not have any reason to believe that she particularly was committing a crime. They did not come to the apartment looking for her. They came looking for two male individuals who were alleged to have been trespassing. So there was no reason for the police particularly, even after they entered the apartment, frankly, to think that she particularly was committing a crime. So I think that the officers used the basis of their warrantless entry to continue that and to get into a situation where they searched her person.
Now, what did the police in their testimony indicate was the reason that they thought they had the right to enter?
The police indicated that they believed that evidence was being destroyed based upon the odor of marijuana.
Now, is that relevant, or can this court hold that the entry was valid under what the state's second justification is, even though the police did not use that as a justification?
No, I do not believe that the state's second argument that the police could enter to arrest because they believe someone was committing a crime is tenable here. First of all, I do not believe there's any probable cause for the officers to arrest anyone. Who were they going to arrest? And this really goes to Justice Bradley's question about do we know the who, the when, the where, and can answer those questions. I don't think, particularly under this court's recent decision in Sechrist, that this court could find that there was probable cause to arrest. All the police smelled was an odor of marijuana. They do not know who might be doing it. They do not know when this might have occurred. And I think there's no indication that this was occurring then. And particularly when one considers when the police entered, there was nothing found. The officers did not see any smoke. There's no reason to believe that this was occurring presently. So I think that there's no linkage in this case in order to establish probable cause to arrest. And this court found that imperative in its decision in Sechrist, that there must be some linkage between the odor and the person. And this is a vastly different case from Sechrist, not only because this involves a home, not a car, but because this is not a confined area such as a car where there's one person seated and the officer has an opportunity to observe that person's relationship between where they're sitting and where the odor is coming from. All we have here are officers out in the hallway. They smell something. They know there are numerous people inside, but they do not know who, and they do not know how to connect that odor with a particular person. So even if they were going to enter, who are they going to arrest once they enter? They do not know who.
Well, what if they saw smoke, but they don't know who? Would that allow them to enter?
I think that that would certainly be a stronger case, but I do not think that would allow them to enter. That's still...
So you have to know, it's your theory that they had to know who was committing the crime in order to enter?
I think that they would have to be able to identify some person in order to know that that's where the odor was coming from. There would certainly have to be more than there was here. The Court of Appeals recently applied Sechrist in State v. Wilson to find that where there were a number of individuals in the basement and one individual walked up the steps of the basement towards the officer, that the officer did not have probable cause to arrest that person because he did not know whether this person was the source of the odor from the basement or whether the other people and were the source of the odor. And so I think that there has to be something more than just the sound of number of voices and the smell in order for the officer to cross that threshold to make an arrest.
Let me ask that because that's a point I've been thinking about. Here we knew, as I asked before, that someone saw Mr. Webb go in the building. Mr. Webb, as I understand it, has had three prior convictions for possession.
That's correct.
And one of those was conviction for smoking marijuana or, you know,
I believe all of them were.
Okay, all of them were. So the officer knew, someone said, Webb is in there. In fact, Webb was in there, but Webb was allegedly sleeping. But does that fact make any difference?
No, I do not think it does in this case. The officer...
Why not? Because you're saying, well, the officer... But the officer knew that Webb was in there. They knew that Webb had three priors and that they also... smell.
The officer did not know that Mr. Webb had prior convictions. There was no testimony in the records that the officer had any knowledge of the prior record of Mr. Webb or of Mr. Smith. That testimony came out through Mr. Webb's testimony at the motion hearing when he testified that he did have those prior convictions, but there's no testimony in the record.
In the facts, and maybe I rely on this, it just said that the officer... one of the officers who responded was familiar with Webb.
That is correct. One of the officers who responded indicated that Mr. Webb had been pointed out to him by another officer and that he had arrested Mr. Smith before, but there was no testimony as to what he arrested Mr. Smith for, and there was no testimony as to why Mr. Webb was pointed out to him before. He did not say that that was because of drug activity, and he did not indicate that he had any prior awareness of Mr. Webb's record. So I think that that factor, although he did admit, yes, he had three prior convictions, I think that does not factor into the analysis here because we have to look at the situation when the officer entered the apartment. The standard is the objective facts known to the officers at the time of entry, and that simply was not known to the officer.
Well, then I misunderstood. I thought the record was that they had known that Rip had a prior conviction.
No, the record did not reflect that.
Why is there a requirement that the officer know who he is going to arrest in order to enter to prevent the destruction of evidence, which is one of the state's alternative arguments here, that the exigency was provided by the need to prevent the destruction of evidence?
Well, that is a separate argument of the state, and my response to that is... My response to that the probable cause to arrest is not the same for that argument. My response to that is to the exigent circumstances, they did not have exigent circumstances. I'm not arguing that they had to know who they were going to arrest in order to enter to search under exigent circumstances, and that's the state's first argument. My response to that is in order to enter to search, they had to have not only probable cause but exigent circumstances, and there simply are not exigent circumstances here.
Right, but under that of the argument, the probable cause is supplied by the odor of marijuana, and the exigency is provided by the ready destructibility of marijuana or other drugs, as well as the circumstances which were then present, which is the chaos that's going on in the house. As soon as the occupants of the house or the apartment know that the police are at the door and are about to come in, and the fact that there are people dashing for the rear rooms of the apartment, and in the officer's common knowledge, the purpose of doing that is to get rid of the evidence.
But I think this court has to look at Johnson versus United States because Johnson says odor alone does not prove destruction of evidence. And even in that case where they said odor of burning marijuana does not prove destruction of evidence, and the Court of Appeals followed that in State versus Keekhyper. So the odor alone, even assuming that that means one cannot assume, is what Johnson says, that that means destruction of evidence, and that simply is not enough.
No, I know that that's what Johnson says, but Johnson did not describe the attending circumstances of the police at the threshold in the way that they are present in this particular case.
But the circumstances were that the court describes of people running down the back hallway, and first of all, the testimony is that two people, they were not identified, they could have been children. As Ms. Hughes testified, her children ran from the front to the back where she was in the bedroom when the police entered, but they did not know that until after they entered, and then the people were running down the hallway. This is not something they knew before they entered, and again, we have to look at what the police knew at the point where they decided to enter the threshold, not what occurred after that to use that to justify the destruction of evidence. And again, the state points to the scream, the sister's scream. There was no testimony by the officers. They relied on a scream, and secondly, the testimony in the record from Ms. Hughes and her sister about the scream most fairly describes her screaming as the police entered with guns drawn because she was afraid, and that's page 61 and page 105 of the transcript when they testified of that. Thirdly, the state discusses the door closing as an exigent circumstance, and I dispute again that that is an exigent circumstance. There's some dispute in the record about, and there were no factual findings by the trial court, there's some dispute in the record about when the door is closed. Ms. Hughes' sister testified, and the Court of Appeals recognized this in their decision, that when she opened the door, there was a question and answer, and that she answered, the officers asked her whether Danny Webb was there, and that she answered that, and then she closed the door. The officers did not testify about a conversation, but that the door was closed immediately. So there's some dispute in the record, but I think even if this court looks at the door closing and decides that there was no question and answer based on the record, I think the door closing itself, it cannot be considered with negative significance, because I think part of the right to privacy under the Fourth Amendment is that we have the right to exclude other people from our homes. Is that not an inherent right in the Fourth Amendment, that if you do not want to talk to a door-to-door salesman, you don't want to talk to your ex-boyfriend who may be at the door, or you don't want to talk to the police, that you have the right to close the door. So I think that that does not have any significance that should weigh into exigent circumstances here.
Counsel, are you familiar with State v. Wilson?
Yes.
Was that published? I don't want to refer to it.
Yes. In fact, I sent this court a letter last week. It has been ordered published.
Well, under that, if you, if they had entered and there was marijuana evidence, could they have arrested anyone?
If they had entered and there was
into the
marijuana
apartment, right, and they found cigarettes, no one was had any in their hands, but there were cigarettes.
I think that it would be difficult to arrest someone in those circumstances because of the multiple people involved. The police could not connect the people or the person to the odor that they had smelled. So I think that under Wilson, because in that case was very factually similar, there were numerous people, and the court found that there's not probable cause to arrest one person who may be coming out of that area because you don't know who to link it to, and that's what this court said in Sechrist.
So if you couldn't arrest somebody under these circumstances and there were many voices, then why should you have a right to enter without a warrant to arrest because you couldn't arrest?
I don't think you should have the right to enter because you do not know those facts. You cannot connect the odor to anyone in particular, and you're merely guessing not only the who, but the when, the where, and how much. And I think that that goes beyond the probable cause determination in this case. That is something that should be determined by the neutral judicial officer, and that's, we're not saying that the police can never enter under the odor, but that they need to apply for a search warrant and let the neutral judicial officer decide what the meaning of that odor is and whether that should then allow the police to enter. And I think that there were other things that the police could have done here. One, certainly they could have gone and applied for the search warrant.
Is it your serious position that there wasn't a great risk that any drugs in the apartment would be destroyed?
No, I think that there certainly is a risk that drugs would be destroyed, but the problem is that with the circumstances that we have here, based on smelling merely of the odor, that is not enough under Johnson.
Well, there was the smelling of the odor.
Correct.
But the people inside the apartment, unlike Ann Johnson, knew that the officers were there.
Well, in Johnson, however, I think they're really factually the same. In Johnson, the officers knocked on the door. They received a response from a female voice inside, and the officer identified himself.
That's true, but they smelled the odor when the door was closed of the burning opium. The person inside the hotel didn't know that the officers were there.
At that point, but when they told her, when she responded and they told her who they were, it's after that point that they entered, and so she had the opportunity at that point to destroy the evidence. So I think that factually they are the same situation.
They didn't have evidence to arrest anybody until they went in.
That's correct.
And searched.
And in fact,
Johnson is a search case, and Secrets is Johnson is an arrest case.
Correct.
And Sechrist is an arrest case. And Wilson is an arrest case. And this is a search case.
Well, the state, again, is presenting two alternative theories. I think that Johnson applies both to search and arrest because there is a discussion in the primary emphasis there, which I think the primary emphasis really needs to be here, is to the entry. The entry is the violation that we are talking about, the crossing of the threshold, whether it is to search or it is to arrest, and certainly the inquiries.
Here, the police did not cross the threshold until they had smelled the odor of marijuana. And until the people inside knew that the police were there. Why is that not an exigent circumstance?
Because, number one, they smelled the marijuana, but Johnson says that's not enough to cross. You're suggesting that they were aware that the police were there, but again, I think the facts in Johnson are really factually the same. She was aware that the police were there prior to their entry, and so I think factually they are the same.
No. Ann Johnson did not know that the police were there prior to their entry. The police smelled the opium, and they knocked on the door, and they go inside. But, I mean, they smelled the opium when the door was closed. They could have gotten a warrant. There were no exigent circumstances until they went inside.
But again, my recollection of the facts in Johnson is that when they smelled the opium and knocked on the door, they got a response, and they then said, it's the police, and then they entered. They identified themselves before they entered the apartment. They identified themselves verbally. Here we have the opening of the door, and the young woman observes them in uniform. So I think factually there is no difference. There's no extra thing here as far as the identification, because in Johnson the police had identified themselves before they entered. So she knew that they were there. There was the same potential under those facts as these for destruction of evidence. And in Johnson, they said that is not enough to allow the police to enter without a warrant. And again, the entry is the focus, although ultimately they determined there was no probable cause to arrest. There is a discussion about when an entry is appropriate to search or arrest. And in some cases, a search warrant may be granted by a neutral magistrate. But again, that was not attempted in this case. Have I answered Ms. Sissa's question?
The second argument of the state, that is that they had the right to enter without warrant because a misdemeanor was being committed in their presence. Do you understand that to, in essence, be that they had a right to enter because there was probable cause to arrest?
Yes. I believe factually they are.
That's what they're really saying.
Yes.
Did you find anywhere in the brief, I missed it, arresting who? Probable cause to arrest who?
No, that is the question that I addressed previously, and that that Your Honor had addressed, who are they going to arrest? I think there's simply no way to know based on the facts in this case when they know that there's multiple people in there, and that's what Johnson said. You cannot enter to find out who's in there and who to connect to the odor and then retroactively justify the entry by an arrest.
Well, if we should hold for the state, then do we have to reverse Wilson?
Yes, I think this court would have to reverse Wilson and Kiekeifer.
And also in the Wilson case, and this is the one you cited, and we got that today.
Yes.
Okay. Also in the Wilson case, there's a discussion of when consent is valid. And the court there says when you looked at the totality of the circumstances, that the defendant, Wilson, had no choice but to allow the search.
Yes, and I think that that is factually the same as the circumstances in this case, and I think applies here as well. What occurred in Mr. Wilson's case, the court found, was mere acquiescence, that he had no choice but to go along, and I think that on the facts of this case, that is essentially what happened, that Ms. Hughes was merely going along with what the officer told her she was going to do.
How many officers were there?
We know that there were at least six. There may have been more, but the testimony is that there were at least six officers in the apartment. All the defense witnesses testified that guns were drawn. All of the witnesses testified that that people were ordered to stay where they were and that their hands were to be placed where they could
see. How large was the apartment?
We're talking about a two-bedroom kitchen and a living room and a bathroom.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
No further questions, Mr. Balestrieri.
It is quite apparent that the defendant and the state have some disagreement about the facts in this case. Unfortunately, the circuit court did not make very specific findings on all of the facts that are in dispute. However, the court did make one very important finding. It was a finding of credibility. It found that the police officers were credible and that the defendant and her witnesses were not credible.
All the officers or just the woman officer who came to do the search?
Well, the court found that the woman officer who did the search was especially credible, but it found that all of the officers were credible. So that when you do have conflicts in the testimony, based on that finding of credibility, you have to go with the police officer's version of the facts.
So, as I looked at the testimony very quickly, it seemed to me all the officers didn't agree. I mean, some couldn't remember whether they were drawn guns.
No, I mean, there is some conflict between the testimony given by the various officers, but on the important points.
What's the important points?
What they knew when they entered the apartment, why they entered the apartment.
What they knew is they smelled marijuana smoke.
Right.
What else? I want to know what the facts are that you say were found that would support this conviction.
The officers testified that, first of all, they were standing by the door. They had previously knocked on the door. It was not open, so they were just standing there waiting for backup officers to arrive. While they were standing there, Vanessa Hughes' younger sister opened the door. They immediately smelled a strong odor of marijuana, which led them to believe that people inside the apartment were smoking marijuana. According to the testimony of the police officers, as soon as, I believe her name was Veronica Hughes, the younger sister, opened the door, she screamed, tried to slam the door.
Counsel, and I think playback of the tape of the record here will show, earlier when you gave the statement of facts, you said, as the police entered, she screamed, and I wrote that down because that statement of facts that you gave in your initial presentation seemed to be inconsistent with what I thought you were going to say. So now you're saying that you're relying, that the facts are that she screamed before the police entered.
Well, this is all one continuous act. I don't think you can parse it out by many seconds. This is one continuous act. The whole thing probably took less than 5 seconds, according to the testimony of the police.
So when you said before that as the police entered, she screamed, you're not sure if that's accurate?
Well, I think that, as I said, this all occurred at the same time. She opens the door, she sees the police, she screams, tries to close the door, they walk in.
I'm more than the facts, and I know that the facts
tie into the law here. I'm interested in the law. It seems to me, regardless of which argument you want to advance, your first argument or your second alternative argument, that both stand ultimately for the proposition, for a blanket rule, that, number one, in your first argument, that if they smell an odor of marijuana, that in all marijuana cases where they smell an odor of marijuana, they can enter because evidence may be destroyed without a warrant. Your second alternative is that they had a right to enter without a warrant because a misdemeanor was committed in their presence. In all cases where they smell marijuana, they can enter because they have probable cause to arrest because a misdemeanor is committed in their presence. I mean, aren't those really blanket rules that you're asking for?
No.
Okay, let's start with the first one. It seems to me that you're saying that the odor of marijuana is sufficient to enter without a warrant because marijuana will be destroyed.
No. What I'm saying is that the odor of burning marijuana.
But we don't have that on the record here, so you've got that problem. The testimony of the officer doesn't mention the word burning as I read the testimony.
No, and I've conceded that he never used the word burning, but he did use the word smoking.
He said there's illegal activity going on.
But one of the officers says there was illegal activity. So both of the officers thought that a crime was being committed at that particular time, not that a crime had been committed at some time in the past and they were just going in to seize the evidence. They thought it was going on at that particular time. And there's other evidence to support that. The fact that there's people in the apartment, there's noise going on, there's music going on, suggests that there's a party going on. People smoke marijuana at parties. The fact that Hughes's younger sister slammed the door immediately, at least according to the testimony of the police officers, which was found to be credible. Why did she slam the door? The reasonable inference is because criminal activity was going on at that time.
You're not going to take the position that every time there's a party, that's probably...
No, I'm not. No, I specifically said I was not arguing for a blanket rule.
What cases, I know that opposing counsel indicated we'd have to overturn the Kiefhoffer case. What the other case was the
Wilson
case. Do we have to overturn that?
I don't know if you have to, but I certainly urge you to.
All right.
Why do you think we don't have to?
Well, I think you could probably distinguish at least the situation in Wilson from the situation in this case, because in Wilson Wilson was an arrest case. Of course, question of probable cause to arrest. This case is not an arrest case. This case is an entry case.
I know, but your second argument rests on that there was probable cause to make an arrest once they entered.
Right, and I'm glad you brought that up because I do want to emphasize this. In order to make an entry, the police do not have to know which specific person is committing the crime. What they have to know in order to justify the entry is that somebody on the other side of the threshold is committing a crime in their presence. They don't have to be able to identify the specific person. They can do that once they've entered the apartment, and if and when they do make an arrest, the person who is arrested can then challenge that arrest on the basis that there is no probable cause to single him out.
Are the exceptions to that you're now advocating to a warrantless search of a house or entry of a house, are those exceptions now eating up the rule that there is no entry without a warrant?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand the question.
The general rule is you don't enter a home without a search warrant or an arrest warrant.
That is correct.
That's the general rule. And if we adopt these exceptions, plus all the other exceptions that there are out there, have these exceptions swallow the rule so that the general rule is you can't enter without a warrant because you're going to find some exception that'll...
Well, first of all, I point out that I'm not asking you to adopt the second exception. You have already adopted it. I'm asking you to reaffirm that exception. And the answer is quite simply, no, it's not going to, these exceptions are not going to swallow up the general rule. We've had this exception for an entry to make a misdemeanor arrest for over 100 years in this state. It certainly has not swallowed up the Fourth Amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Balestrieri. Thank you, counsel. That ends our hearing on State v. Hughes. I believe that our first group of students from Albany High School will be leaving. Is that correct? Well,